From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headlee. Getting a recipe just right takes dedication.
We did a chocolate cake 130 times, which is insane.
America's Test Kitchen co-founder Chris Kimball is crazy about food. We talk more with him ahead this hour. But first, we asked for your gripes about the worst driving habits on the road here in Georgia. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Edward Austin Hall calling from the gorgeous but automotively dangerous Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. Atlantans, you do not live in London. Please stay to the right side of the center line unless some city official is directing you to go around. People cross the center line to park on the left side of the street all the time, and guess what? It's illegal and it's dangerous. I almost got run over by somebody driving on the left side of the road.
Oh, that's a good take. That's a hot take. Carly Cooper tweets, I hate when people in the left lane drive so fast, don't give you the chance to get over to the right lane, then come around you. Neil Cassidy says, we are the worst at using the little lever on the left of the steering wheel. Maybe the newer vehicles don't have one. We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. The fallout from data breaches at Atlanta-based Equifax stretches far and wide. At the end of July, the credit rating company learned it had been hacked, exposing more than 140 million people, 140 million people to possible ID theft. But we didn't find out about the hack until this month, and at that time we learned of an earlier Equifax hack. Now the company faces lawsuits, investigations, and a massive drop in its stock price. So what's going on here? Let's bring in Tamar Hallerman from Capitol Hill. She's covering this story for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tamar, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And Trey Kaysen is here, and he is with the consumer advocacy group Georgia Watch. He is here to help us understand how we can better protect our information. Trey, good morning.
Good morning.
And Trey, let me start with you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. Look, I think I'm trying to understand the dimensions, first of all, of this hack of Equifax. We know that the Yahoo breach was huge. How does that compare? Talk about the dimensions of the Equifax hack and what information is now out there.
Sure, yeah. So while the Yahoo hack was very wide, this hack is very wide and very deep. So hackers were able to gain information to your name, your birthday, social security numbers, current address, all prior addresses.
Oh, wow.
Even for a number of people, their driver's license and their credit card numbers.
Wow. Tamar, look, walk us through the timeline of this hack. Our understanding is that the hack happened in, well, it may have started in May, but Equifax found out about it in July?
Yeah, something like that. And we didn't hear about it till about 2 weeks ago. And the fallout has been pretty immense here on Capitol Hill, for sure. A lot of people launching investigations in federal agencies, state attorneys general, on Capitol Hill in different committees. This is something that's going to be around for a very long time.
Okay, so give me, Tamar, give me an idea of the kinds of questions. You know, the questions at this point are just as important as the answers. We may not be satisfied with the answers, ultimately. But give me an idea of what it is that these agencies, congressional bodies are looking for. What questions do you have as a reporter?
Sure. So right now, my understanding is that, you know, the investigation, at least the one that Georgia's attorney general is looking at, they're looking at civil, you know, looking at this as kind of a civil case, not as a criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most interesting parts of this for me is that, you know, the news came out about a week ago that some of Equifax's top executives had sold stock in the company after they had heard about the breach, but before it went public. So there's questions about that. There's questions about, you know, how long it took until Equifax figured out that they'd been hacked, why it took them so long to alert people, who did this, where were their vulnerabilities in the system? And there's also a much larger debate that's to be had in the corridors of Capitol Hill about what should be done. Should Congress pass some sort of federal cybersecurity law saying, you know, you need to put these safeguards in place ahead of time for your security systems.
And Tamar, the actions of the executives, that's really interesting territory, it seems to me, because it does get to this timeline, right? When did those executives learn of the hack and their actions after they learned of it? And then the question of, did Equifax follow kind of the rules? I guess there are rules for disclosing what happened here. And did they follow those rules in a timely way? What's our understanding of that kind of a timeline?
Sure. And that's the thing is we really don't have a great sense yet of how long it took them to kind of figure it out and why it took so long for them to alert consumers. What was interesting to me as I've started reporting this over the last week or two is that there are not a ton of laws in place, even when it comes to after the fact, after you've been hacked, the rules for telling your customers that they've been part of a breach. Yeah. There's no federal law saying you have to say within 30 days or you need to alert your customers when X, Y, and Z happen. There are some laws on the state level that that govern that. But in Georgia, my understanding, and Trey can tell me if I'm wrong, is that there's no exact timeline for when they have to alert consumers in the state.
What do you know about that, Trey?
Right. And so that is actually one of the spaces that we would like to see action on the legislative side. We would love to see something, some type of rule that would mandate whenever there's a large breach of information, whatever the industry, that there would be a reasonable timeline where they would have to inform the affected consumers and or the public in general.
Right, right. Is it true that there is no federal law regarding consumer protections that sort of lays out what those agencies should actually be doing to protect our data?
Sure. So so there have been calls, even some Georgia representatives that are calling for these credit reporting agencies to be held to the highest standard of data protection. So I think.
And what does that look like? What does the highest standard even look
like?
Sure.
So right now it seems that the industry operates on best practices. So just comparing themselves to one another.
Right, right, right. So I'm also curious to understand, is it odd to you, Trey, that Georgia lawmakers are essentially kicking around legislation? I don't know if any's been passed at this point, but certainly kicking around legislation to shield credit reporting agencies, essentially placing caps on claims?
Right. Yeah. So they would actually deny that claim that was the intention of the legislation.
Yeah, sure
so,
they would. Yeah.
Right. So Georgia Representative Barry Loudermilk actually recently introduced legislation that would cap damages from class action lawsuits at $500,000, any lawsuit that was brought against a credit reporting agency. It would also eliminate punitive damages.
Mm-hmm.
And so Georgia Watch, in accordance or along with the National Association of Consumer Advocates, wrote Barry Loudermilk asking him to withdraw this legislation. He responded in the form of a press release saying that this mischaracterizes the intent of his legislation and they have not withdrawn it.
Yeah. Trey, give us a sense. I mean, I think the other piece of this, and I'm trying to figure out just how outraged I should be.
Mm.
To what extent Equifax has done the right thing by its clients, its consumers.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out now that we're in this space, what do I need to do to sort of better protect myself and my information?
Yeah, so there's a few things that we would advise all consumers across the country and in the state of Georgia to do to protect themselves. The first thing is that they can go to EquifaxSecurity2017.com and put in their information and find out whether or not their information was part of the breach. Mm-hmm. And so from there, they'll be able to sign up for something called Trusted ID, which Equifax puts forth kind of as their protection product.
Yeah.
So initially, they got into some trouble because that product, when you signed up for it, you signed a mandatory arbitration clause, which would waive your right to take legal action against them in the form of...
And they were called out for that, weren't they?
They were, and so they removed that. They also got into a little bit of trouble because they were asking for your credit card number, because after the free year expires, they would sign you up for another year. This year, you'd be paying for.
Mm-hmm.
So now all that's cleared up, and we would say that their credit monitoring software is good. Sign up for that. The next thing we would say is everyone needs to take a credit freeze. Sign up for a credit freeze with all three of the major reporting agencies. And what that's going to do—
Because this can happen with other agencies as well, right?
Absolutely, right. So so we would say put a credit freeze on. That would be the number one line of defense for
everyone. And do that now. Do that
now. Oh, yeah. Do it yesterday. And so that's going to be $3 in the state of Georgia. It's free for seniors. Equifax is actually waiving the fee right now. And parents can sign up their children. So anyone under 16 can be signed up by a parent. And what that's going to do is it's just going to lock your credit report down. Mm-hmm. And it's going to make it difficult for anybody to take out a new line of credit. And that's going to protect you from
Is the fee just for locking it down, or is there another fee to thaw that information?
Right. So there would be a fee to thaw the information if, in case you wanted to, let's say, get a car loan, you know, down the line. So
well, doggone it, it's not a lot of money, but I mean, it's still coming out of my pocket.
Sure.
And it's because these agencies seemingly have not figured out a way to protect our data.
Right. So we would say that the onus is on them. Right, the onus is on them to make sure that this information is correct. So, actually, one of the pieces of legislation that we would like to see passed is that all credit freezes would be free or cheap across the country.
Free, yeah, we like the idea.
Right.
Seen on Capitol Hill over the last week or so, a lot of lawmakers have mentioned, hey, I'm going to craft a legislative response to this hack. But one of the ones we have seen from some Senate Democrats, including Elizabeth Warren, is a bill that would give free credit freezes to people. So haven't heard anything from leaders about whether this is something they'd consider, but there certainly is a ton of outrage, and perhaps it is possible.
Okay, so yeah, I guess I'm sitting here trying to gauge what level of outrage is appropriate here. And part of that answer, it seems to me, is tied to, you know, a realization of the space that we live in terms of cybersecurity, internet security. Tamar and then Trey. Tamar, look, in reporting this story in the way that you have, and probably other stories in the space as well, what have you come to understand about this whole idea of privacy when it comes to our information online?
What's been so interesting to me is I know that this is something that in Washington lawmakers have been trying to solve for a long time. And I assume the reason they couldn't do that was because it was a partisan issue, like everything here on Capitol Hill. What I've learned is that it really isn't. There have been plenty of bipartisan proposals that have been floating around on Capitol Hill for the better part of a decade now. What's interesting, though, is all the myriad interests from different business groups and from privacy advocates and states' rights people and bankers and retailers. Everybody has their own set of demands. And you know, it's such a mess of interests that there's nothing these lawmakers can do that will satisfy everybody. So my understanding is that's why it's been so tough to get any sort of privacy protection on Capitol Hill over the last few years.
Yeah, and Trey, you get what I'm driving at here. It's just we have to assume that privacy doesn't exist anymore, does it?
Right. And to piggyback off of what Tamar was saying, if there's a silver lining for this being so broad, is that it does affect everybody across party lines. And so we think that this is a good opportunity to reopen the conversation about internet privacy, you know, personal information, who gets to collect, store, and share this information.
Yes. Trey, appreciate it. Thank you so much. Trey Kaysen is with the consumer advocacy group Georgia Watch. We also heard from Atlanta Journal-Constitution Washington correspondent Tamar Hallerman. Thank you both. Great information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just ahead, we meet a young Georgia chef who is making a name for herself at the ripe old age of 12. But first, Chef Chris Kimball on his most challenging recipes. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Few people are as dedicated to teaching people how to cook as Christopher Kimball. He published the magazine Cooks Illustrated and co-founded the popular TV and radio show America's Test Kitchen.
And we cooked it with the butter until it starts to set. Put the top on, let it sit for a minute. Then we have to put it back on the heat for 20 seconds.
That's right.
Turn it out. Use the napkin rolling technique. Have I left anything out
That's
here?
That's it.
Last year, he launched a new project, Milk Street. The Boston-based venture teaches cooking, publishes a magazine, and makes a TV show.
So, Chris, you can see our sauce is cooked down. It's been about 5 minutes, and the colors also changed to this deep, beautiful emerald green.
You know, I had a small pond in Vermont once that looked just like that. It was kind of stagnant, you know.
But did you taste it?
No, I didn't. Even the cows wouldn't drink out of it.
Milk Street is also going on a live tour, and my colleague Celeste Headley caught up with Chris Kimball last week.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. You know, I've always wondered, because I mean, I'm a kind of a fangirl. I probably have seen you for years and years and years and own every single thing, including Milk Street that you've published. What is the most you've ever had to make of a recipe? I mean, sometimes they describe, you guys have described making dozens of batches of things. What was the toughest?
Well, this would be at America's Test Kitchen. Years ago, we did a chocolate cake 130 times, I think.
Holy cow.
Which is insane. I mean, yeah. I'm now reformed. I'm going to Recipe Testing Anonymous. Now, we will keep it down to 10 or 12 times probably now. And our philosophy now is that we spend a lot of time on the front end figuring out what we want to test and what's really important. So I've gotten away from the 100 tests, but you still have to make it more than three or four times.
Yeah, and a lot of that, when you talk about figuring out on the front end, does that mean you're sort of figuring out scientifically how it might work before you even crack open a bag of flour?
Well, I think what it means is you're very clear about what you're after before you get into the testing. Sometimes tests take a turn, you know, an unexpected turn, but you're very clear about what you want out of a recipe before you start. You know, it's like the old Vermont expression, if you don't know where you're going, you can take any road, it'll get you there, you know? So you want to be really careful where you're trying to head up. I think also, if you're trying to do recipes that people are familiar with, like a chocolate chip cookie or an apple pie or whatever, then, you know, you're trying to perfect it to get the best version of that thing. What we're doing now is very different, which is we're going around the world and trying to put together a sort of a new repertoire. So it's less a question of perfecting something people are already familiar with. We're introducing something new. So it's a little different in terms of what we're testing for.
Is there a particular either ingredient or type of recipe that you know is usually going to be problematic for a home cook? Like I would assume maybe dough, because it's so difficult
yes.
to keep the yeast at the right temperature and keep it alive, et cetera, et cetera. Is that the most tricky thing?
Pie dough probably is the hardest thing because you have to cut the fat into the flour just right and use just the right amount of liquid. And if it's too dry, it falls apart. If it's too wet, it turns out bakes up tough. Yes, dough. We just did a piece in the new issue on pizza dough. And it turns out the most important factor in pizza dough is the temperature of the dough before you shape it and bake it off. And if it's 75 degrees, it's malleable, it'll bubble up, it'll be chewy. If it's 65 degrees or 68 degrees, it won't be. So that's something that people don't realize is the temperature of the dough, not just how much water is in it.
While
it's rising too, because if it's going to be 65 degrees, it's going to take a long time to rise. But before you pre-shape it into the four balls, if you're making that kind of recipe, you can let it sit in the fridge for a day if you want to develop flavor. You don't have to. Then you let it rise. Yeah, you want to rise in a warm place. But before you actually start to shape the dough into a pizza, you want to make sure that dough is around 75 degrees. If it's too cool, it'll be hard to shape, and it won't bake up right. It won't bubble up. It'll be a little tough. So the texture and the flavor of it will be much better, and it's easier to work with. So temperature, it turns out, is the most important thing in pizza.
What keeps you in this business? I mean, essentially, for decades now, you have been teaching people, and the recipes are so precise that even somebody with almost no experience in the kitchen could successfully make your chocolate chip cookie, right? What keeps you doing that?
No one's ever asked me that before. That's a good question. What else am I going to do? I can't go rabbit hunting every day or grow potatoes. I love what I do. I mean, look, what a great business. I mean, you sit down, you have a kitchen, you have people testing recipes, you argue about recipes, you taste recipes, you do a TV show, you do a radio show. I mean, you do a magazine. It's just really fun. And I'd say in the last few years, what keeps me going now is I've completely changed how I cook. I mean, it's a totally different ball game. I cook a lot more than I have in years, and I'm back at the beginning of the learning curve, really.
So what has kind of gone wrong, I guess, in our kitchens across America, because with all of this, the time-saving appliances, and we now have all the different things that make it so much easier to cook now than, say, my grandmother did, why do so few people actually cook their own dinners?
A lot of reasons. It started in the 70s and 80s when women came into the, you know, the marketplace in large numbers, as they should have, which meant there was fewer people at home. Two, the alternatives are there. There's Blue Apron, you know. There's prepared foods at Whole Foods markets and other places. A lot of restaurants versus 20, 30 years ago. So you have lots of alternatives to cooking your own food. And I think the biggest problem was people viewed, and this goes back to the 19th century, the 1880s actually, people viewed cooking as a necessary evil to get food on the table. And when you view it as a chore, not a pleasure, you try to avoid it. What's happened in the last 10 or 15 years is I think we're redefining what cooking is. It's not a chore. It's actually pleasurable. And once you get to the point that you enjoy it, then it's something you'll do more of. But for all those reasons, it's just a different place than it was in when Fanny Farmer wrote her cookbook in 1896, when there just weren't that many choices.
So how do you go about, when you go about writing a recipe down for other people? You know, I've read cookbooks that, for me, I'm just a cook. I'm not a chef. So when I sometimes read, say, Jamie Oliver, and he says, add a dash of whatever. And I'm like, I don't know what a dash is, which is one of the reasons that I loved America's Test Kitchen, why I really like Milk Street, because it tells me exactly how much. What decisions do you have to make when you're actually writing a recipe down for someone else to
That's
recreate.
A good question. Well, yeah, I've made my career based on the huge difference between how people actually cook at home and how people think people cook at home. It's a different world. People will leave out entire steps. They'll substitute ingredients wildly. My favorite was someone substituted shrimp for chicken once, you know, in a recipe and came out tough, oddly enough. People do all sorts of crazy things. And I think in part because they don't want to follow a recipe. They want to improvise. They want to be artistic. And so they feel it's beneath them to do what the recipe says. And I always say the first time you make a recipe, please follow it step by step. But if you've been doing this a long time, they're just things you know people are going to do. For example, they'll substitute one cut of meat for another. That happens all the time. Or they'll substitute chicken breast for chicken thighs, which completely changes everything. Or they may not have a particular kind of ingredient, so they'll put something else in. Or their oven's off 40 degrees or 50 degrees from what they think. And so if you say bake for 40 minutes, that's useless. You know, what you do is say bake for 20 minutes, open the oven, turn it around, look at it, check it every 3 or 4 minutes after that. So there's some things that you see over time that reoccur, and you just want to make sure that people are paying attention to that.
And has that job changed? And I say that because in my grandmother's day, she could read cookbooks that didn't have a lot of instruction because she had been educated in the kitchen. I wasn't. Yeah. So they say, you know, look for shiny sauce, and I don't know what shiny looks like. Does that mean you have to be more instructive?
Yes, it does. If you pick up the original Fanny Farmer, they have replica copies you can buy. If it's to make a pie pastry, she used three words: make a paste. Period. Paste was a pie dough. That's all she said because everyone knew how to do it because they made it 3 times a week. Now, if I were to describe how to make pie pastry, it would take me 300 or 400 words because you have to talk about the butter and the Crisco and how cold it should be and how big the pieces should be, and how to describe how far to cut the fat into the flour using a food processor or using your hands, and what should the color of the flour look like, and what should it feel like, and how much water to add and how not to add too much. And yes, so you have to go into a lot more detail.
So tell me about a surprise that you had. You know, I have used for a long time the America Test Kitchen recipe that puts vodka in the pie crust to make it dry and flaky, which is a revelation to me.
It's a great recipe.
Yeah. What kind of surprises have you had in the kitchen where you either added an ingredient or changed something that you would have never expected?
Well, at Milk Street, I've had to unlearn a lot of things I thought were true. For example, I don't use stock, store-bought stock, hardly at all, because if you cook a chicken or a piece of beef in water, you create your own stock. And that's a very French tradition, which really, there are times you use stock, but most of the time you don't need to. I don't saute meat, you know, before I make a stew or a soup, for example, because you have meat. I don't need to double down on the umami flavor. I want the other flavors to come through. Ottolenghi introduced me to this, which is using handfuls of herbs, right? Like 2 cups of cilantro or 2 cups of parsley or 1 cup of basil or dill. Massive quantities of things like that, you know, spices. Most of the cooking in Northern Europe barely use spices. French cooking doesn't use spices hardly at all. Places in the Middle East will use 3 tablespoons of sumac, you know, or 2 tablespoons of cumin. I mean, so all the rules I grew up with, which are mostly English and French, some of that stuff still makes sense, but some of it doesn't. In other words, there are very different ways of thinking about what cooking is in different places in the world. And so I've had to sort of let that go, you know, and sort of clear out my head and take a fresh look, because there are other ways of thinking, entirely different ways of thinking about what is cooking and what is food and what is dinner.
How different are these recipes? Well, let me put it another way. How much can somebody who just does not have the equipment that you have follow the recipes in Milk Street? Do you need a set of French sauté pans to be able to...
No. I mean, don't forget, most people in the world don't have much equipment. I mean, a lot of places in the world, they don't even have ovens in their kitchen, like Vietnam. You know, they just have stovetops. Or Thailand, same thing. They have a propane burner or two. So the French had more, you know, batterie de cuisine cookware than anybody. So if you go anywhere else in the world, you're dealing with much, you know, many fewer things and not expensive things. So no, 85% or 90% of the recipes in Milk Street don't call for things that are hard to find. We occasionally will, like sumac is a, it's a berry. It's was used as a lemon in the Middle East, really a sort of sour and fresh tasting. And there are recipes that, where it's all about the sumac, so we'll call for that. But 85-90% of the time, these are things that you either have at home or can get easily in your local supermarket. So it's not about exotica. I mean, when I was learning to cook in the 60s and 70s, you know, there was ethnic cooking, a term I don't love, but it was about authentically preparing a dish from Oaxaca, you know, a mole sauce, and it took all day, and this and the other thing. Well, that's not what's going on now. Everyone's talking about home cooking, Tuesday night cooking. And so there's simplicity to all of this. And all cultures, you know, have the same approach. They're not going to spend all day cooking dinner on a Wednesday night. So simplicity is really at the core of all of this. Whereas French cooking, I think, to a large extent, is not about sometimes, but is not about simplicity.
So what effects do you think has the changes in cooking habits had on greater society? I mean, you must have thought about this a bit, the connection, say, between the obesity epidemic and, fast food or not cooking at home. How has our either propensity to cook our own meals or not cook our meals affected our lives, the quality of our lives?
Well, the two separate things. There's the whole fast food phenomenon, which is terrible with adult onset diabetes and the sodas and everything else and supersize me. That's a problem. I think one reason I'm such a proselytizer for home cooking is it's very hard to make yourself sick cooking at home, you know, because it's inherently healthier because you're cooking from scratch most of the time. I do think, though, that most of the world starts with big flavor ingredients, chilies, spices, herbs, ginger, scallions, fish sauce, soy sauce, etc. You can get big flavors at home now pretty easily, whereas that's not true in French cooking. French cooking starts with fairly mild ingredients and then over a period of time develops flavor. That can give people what they want. People want big flavor. They always have. And so that's why they go to fast food, right? It's full of fat, it's full of salt, it's full of big flavors. You can get that at home now without more time and effort because all the stuff's available and we're cooking differently. And everyone knows, people go out to restaurants. They know people can go to a Tibetan restaurant in the middle of Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, for example. So that gives me some hope that people can get what they really want fairly quickly and easily, you know, maybe that will offset to some degree this rush to fast foods that occurred in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So what do people see at the live show version of Milk Street, as opposed to watching the TV show?
I see me make a complete fool of myself, which, of course, is always entertaining, and I'm very good at that. I figured out a couple of years ago that a live event's about the audience and the person on the stage and interaction. So, you know, I'm not there to lecture anybody. I'm there to bring people up on stage to do a tasting or a cook-off or a quiz or have some fun, a lot of Q&A. You know, we're there. If anybody, you know, two people cook, you know, they have something in common. And so I have something in common with everybody who comes to the show. And we're just not there to have fun, you know. And I like to make fun of the audience, you know, some of the stupid things they do in the kitchen. And then they get to make fun of me. So that's what it is. It's that back and forth. And that's what makes a fun evening for me anyway.
That's Chris Kimball. He's cook, TV and radio personality, founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, and he'll bring Milk Street live to the First Center for the Arts at Georgia Tech tonight at 7:30. Chris, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was my colleague Celeste Headley speaking with Christopher Kimball last week. Just ahead, why there's been a staggering rise in the number of Americans with epilepsy. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headley. More and more Americans are diagnosed with epilepsy every year, according to recent data published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For the first time, the information includes epilepsy numbers from every state. They show more than 3.4 million people in the U.S. are epileptic. And with me now to discuss the data is Rosemarie Kobau, a health scientist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Rosemarie, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us on Skype is Joseph Servin, a professor of neurology with the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. Joseph, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And you two are colleagues. You know each other.
We are colleagues, yes.
Well, it's terrific to have you both. Rosemarie, let me start with you. I guess I was initially surprised by all the things I thought I knew but really didn't know about this condition. Mm-hmm. Maybe a good place for us to start is to have you explain epilepsy, the condition that is not just one condition, really.
Sure. So epilepsy is a neurological disorder that's characterized by the tendency to have recurrent seizures. You know, the brain is made up of billions of nerve cells that sort of talk with each other using tiny electrical signals, and sometimes those signals misfire. So a seizure is an abnormal burst of electrical activity that causes sudden and temporary changes in how a person feels, thinks, or behaves.
You know, and Joseph, I wonder if you could tell us who's at risk for epilepsy, and do you necessarily know if you have it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. First of all, one of the things in terms of risk for epilepsy is literally all age groups.
Yes.
A lot of people think it's just something of young adults or kids. The truth is, if you look at the numbers, which we'll get to in a moment, mm-hmm. which is the fact that you see the biggest pools of people tend to be the very young, and then those, the other pool that a lot of people don't realize, are the older group, the ones that are 65 years and older. And so all are, any age group is actually at risk. Now, some people are very aware that they have seizures when they present, but some, because of where the seizures arise from, it can actually come from the same areas that produce memory. So for some people, this is like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So those folks, it gets to be very complicated because they think this is not happening, but family and friends are bringing them to your attention.
And if I could just add something, as Joe mentioned, all ages and all racial and ethnic groups are at risk. But our findings and other studies from other countries have found that people at lowest income levels are at higher risk of developing epilepsy.
Why is that?
Well, we don't know exactly. However, some risk factors might be more common in those groups. So, for example, poor prenatal care. That low-income, women are not able to get or are dealing with poor prenatal care. Mm-hmm. So certainly that could be one reason.
Okay.
And infections that might be more common in, again, individuals who don't have access to care and vaccinations.
So, Joseph, as I continue to try to expand sort of my understanding of this, my understanding is that epilepsy is something that is a part of the genetic makeup of people who have it. But do we understand fully what triggers it in people?
Yeah, and the truth is, what exactly triggers someone to have seizures versus not is probably something we don't know.
Okay.
But I guess what's an important point is, if you think of the brain as one amazing chemical battery, the fact is every brain has certainly the potential for seizure. But what's probably set in genetics is the threshold to which these external things, whatever the cause may be, throws you over to having a seizure. So if you think of it in that direction, all of us are at risk for it. It's just that we're set at different set points at what's going to bring us to that point that you actually have the seizure.
Mm. Rosemary, so we learned from the study that more people are living with epilepsy than we thought. My understanding is the last study of this kind was in 2012. And what's changed since 2012 in that study?
Yes, so we published our study in 2012, but the data were collected in 2010. Hmm. And we found that the number of adults with active epilepsy, which again includes adults who are diagnosed with epilepsy and who report being under treatment or having recent seizures, that the number of those adults with active epilepsy rose from 2.3 million in 2010 to just under 3 million in 2015. And the number of children with the condition increased from 450,000 in 2007 to about 470,000 in 2015.
I want to get to what you're learning from people who are living with epilepsy in a moment. But is there a reason, Rosemary, that we are just learning, getting more numbers from all the states in the country? Is there a reason for that?
Well, in part, epilepsy hasn't been included as a question on most states' surveillance systems. CDC works with states to collect data on something called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. But again, there haven't been resources to support epilepsy questions until recently.
Gotcha. So this area of living with epilepsy, boy, people tell really compelling stories about dealing with it, living with it, and trying to go on with a normal life. Let's share a bit of a story from athlete Jenny LeBaugh. She is one of the millions of Americans that you just mentioned who are living with epilepsy. She shared her story on YouTube.
The hardest part was getting it out, just letting people know. You're told that you're not going to be able to get your driver's license, or you're not going to be able to have children, or there's all these things that you're not going to be able to do that the normal person would be able to do.
Joseph, look, Jenny has grand mal seizures. She's on medication, where she describes living with the feeling you get when you hit your funny bone in your arm. Now, look, there's nothing funny about that. That's pretty tough. Where are we when it comes to developing better treatments for epilepsy, given that there is no cure at this point?
Yeah, you know, here's the good news. There's a lot of new treatments. In fact, from when I started practicing in this area almost 20 years to where we are now, we've gone from 3 drugs to 28 drugs. We've gone from 1 surgical procedure to about 4 surgical procedures, a diet. There are 3 devices that you can implant. There's lots of options, but I don't think people are very well aware of how many of those options that we are. Even with those options, you're right, we are very limited on the cure, and we still have a lot to do and to go there. But I do have a message of hope, which is, we have a lot of things that we can offer that can make meaningful differences in people's lives.
Yeah, if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with CDC health scientist Rosemary Cabal and neurology professor Joseph Servin. Rosemary, tell me what you're learning from people living with epilepsy about how they're going on with their life, how they're dealing with what is oftentimes the stigma of epilepsy?
Sure. Well, it's important to note that many people with epilepsy, especially those who do have good seizure control, do have a good quality of life and can contribute in meaningful ways. But certainly, epilepsy is very challenging for a large proportion of people with epilepsy. And in part, it's due to the challenges of the disorder itself. Having seizures, uncontrolled seizures that can happen anytime, are distressing. Certainly, it's anxiety provoking. The treatment, some medications, especially some of the older medications, can cause side effects that for some people are actually worse than the infrequent seizures that they might have. Many people with epilepsy, almost about half, are likely to struggle with mood disorder, depression, again, anxiety. And as we heard from the previous segment, there are limitations that people with epilepsy face that others with other chronic disorders don't necessarily face, such as driver's license restrictions,
yes,
limitations with employment. Certainly there are children with epilepsy experience, challenges in school. And again, having some types of seizures can be very distressing for onlookers to see. And so people with epilepsy face and feel stigmatized.
Yeah. I'm going to have to let that be the last word. But I thank you both for coming in and for the conversation this morning.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Joseph Servin, a professor of neurology with the Mayo Clinic and editor for epilepsy.com. And with me here in studio is Rosemarie Cabau, a health scientist with the CDC. Enjoyed that. Thank you. Thank
you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Southern food is superb, thanks to Southern cooks and chefs, even the young ones. Earlier this year, 12-year-old Jasmine Stewart of Milton took first place in Fox's MasterChef Junior competition. We join Jasmine and her proud family in their Milton, Georgia kitchen.
The winner of MasterChef Junior. Congratulations. Jasmine!
Hi, I'm Jasmine Stewart. I was on the show MasterChef Junior, and I was actually the winner of this season.
This is the biggest moment in my entire life. Whoever thought that a little girl from Milton, Georgia would ever be able to win MasterChef Junior?
My parents definitely inspired me in the kitchen. When I was actually on the show, it was really awesome thinking about my family's culture and history.
All right, Jasmine, what are you cooking for us tonight?
I am making a jerk pork chop with a garlic and ginger broccolini, roasted sweet potatoes, and a orange gastric sauce.
When I made dishes from my dad's side of the family, incorporating Jamaican flair and Jamaican flavors, it really inspired me to ask my dad about his past and learn more about our family and our history. So I think a thing for food is that the recipes that my parents teach me and the things that they teach me, I can go back and ask them questions, and there's always a story. So that's pretty cool.
Stephen Stewart, I'm Jasmine's father. She is very curious, very inquisitive, and she wanted to know where I grew up, how I grew up, where I went to school, what it was like to be in Jamaica. She's always asking me to speak in the Jamaican dialect, which I've always refused. So she's brought a curiosity about my heritage.
I would say it's really important to know your history behind a dish that you're making, just because for me, when I was making dishes that I knew kind of was inspired by my dad and made me put even more effort into it and put myself even more into the plate and make the dish better. And I think the more that you express yourself and find something that makes you happy and that's intriguing to you, the better the dish will be. So I just added the tomatoes in here. And I just want the tomatoes just to get a little bit blistered. So right now we're in my kitchen, and today I'm actually going to prepare a dish. So I'm going to make honey soy ginger salmon with cauliflower couscous and zucchini, cucumber, and asparagus salad. All right, so now I have to grind this up in the food processor. I was about 3 years old when I really started having an interest in cooking. I was making a dish with my mom, and it did not go so well. We were actually making pancakes together, and I had spilled the eggs everywhere and all over the place, and it was crazy just because I made a humongous mess, and I didn't think that that was going to happen, but it did. But luckily, my mom just told me it was going to be okay. We cleaned it up. And that let me know that, hey, even if you mess up, it's going to be okay. You can start over.
I'm Deborah Stewart. I'm Jasmine's mother.
As far as her going into cooking or not going into cooking as a career, I support whatever direction she decides to go into. I think that my advice to Jasmine is to do what she enjoys. And I think if you're doing something that you enjoy overall, you will be successful at it. I think no matter what she does, she will always have a love for cooking. So I don't think that will ever stop. But I think she's still trying to figure out what path she's going to go down.
I think it is a little bit frustrating when adults don't think that kids can cook as well as we do, because I think every kid has something that they're passionate about, whether it be sports or whether it be cooking or whether it be technology. And there's a such thing called a prodigy. And kids can do super well if they're determined about something and if it's something that really excites them, which for me is cooking. So I don't think that you should underestimate us.
It has to be one of the strongest dishes ever. It is great that you left this competition because you've come back with a vengeance. Whatever happens, if you don't get through, I think this is your best shot. Great job.
Thank you.
That's TV host Gordon Ramsay talking with 12-year-old Jasmine Stewart of Milton, Georgia, on the Fox TV show MasterChef Junior. Jasmine won the show's top prizes last season, a nice trophy and $100,000. The runner-up was Justice Mayberry of Sugar Hill, Georgia. Congrats to both our Georgia girls. That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We talked about how cooking can be a way to preserve family stories. Tell us about a recipe that holds special meaning for you. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.